Welcome to the More Perfect Union, a podcast about the joy we get from the American politics, or as we call it, real debate without the hate. I'm Greg Matuszak, a liberal Democrat from Cincinnati, Ohio.
I'm Cliff Dunn, a Republican from Newport News, Virginia.
I'm DJ McGuire, your conservative Democrat from Suffolk, Virginia.
And I'm Kevin Kelton, a moderate Democrat living in Southern California. A More Perfect Union can be found on iTunes, iHeartRadio, and at our website, moreperfectunionpodcast.com. Wow, gentlemen, it's the Sunday after Thanksgiving. We've survived our families and talking about politics over the Thanksgiving table. But what was the big conversation starter at Thanksgiving for you guys politically? Did any fights break out?
Oh, they put me at the kids' table.
Well, that's every year.
Every year they put me at the kids' table so fights won't break out. And which pony was the best pony? So that was as political as I got this year. What about you guys?
Everybody in my family voted for Hillary, both primaries and elections, so we got along famously.
We were actually driving for most of Thanksgiving to get to Baltimore for ChessyCon, a science fiction convention that my wife was involved in. So we didn't really get a chance to sit at the Thanksgiving day dinner table very much. And for the time that we were there, politics was never really discussed.
And you, Cliff?
Oh. Well, the more political aunts and uncles didn't show up this year, so it was actually surprisingly tame because almost everybody was agreeing on preferring a Trump victory.
Wow. For everybody, it was real Thanksgiving without the hate.
Wow, that was nice. But you know, what I'm finding out is this election is more like Godfather 3 more and more.
It keeps pulling us back in?
Because they keep pulling us back. Just when we think we're out, they keep pulling us back in.
You're not referring to the upcoming recount, are you?
Yes, and the one person who I couldn't stand throughout this entire thing, the liberal Democrat couldn't stand, Jill Stein, is, of course, pulling me back into this election. Once we thought it was safe to go back in the water, we're back into this election. Yes, of course, the recount.
Yeah.
The recount, that is, I guess, going to happen, it looks like. We heard threats about this. Computer analysis said that there was no way this could happen. All the pollsters said this couldn't have happened, but it happened. So in four states.
I know so far that there's a recount that has been agreed to by the state of Wisconsin. I'm not sure that the other two or three states have yet made a decision on whether a recount will happen or not. So does anybody know, is this going to be a true hand recount, or are they simply going to retabulate counties and go through kind of a pro forma recount?
I do not know. I don't think the specifics have been released or have been made public unless you are in the know, but I think it is going to be a hand count. Just for those of us who've lived through 2000 and through that torture.
But how do you do it? You can't do a hand count of electric machines. The problem, as I understand it, is aside from the accuracy of the physical count, is whether the electronic voting machines, the Diebold machines, as I believe they're called, whether there was something screwy with them, which of course has been a contention ever since the 2004 presidential election, where some people felt that Kerry might have actually carried Ohio had it not been for those machines. Unless they're going to do an audit of those machines and make sure that they're working correctly, which, by the way, still may not be fully accurate because, from what I understand, any malware that's planted on a machine ahead of the election can be programmed to kill itself and show no trace of itself after a couple of days. But unless they do that, I mean, Trump is still going to be president of the United States.
Well, and if they're just doing a recount in Wisconsin, it's an utterly pointless exercise, arguably, because that would still leave him with 296 electoral votes.
Right. No, they have to do at least three states, and she has to turn three states, which, you know, is not going to happen. Hillary Clinton is not going to win the election. By the way, as much as I would like Hillary Clinton to be the next president of the United States, I have to acknowledge, as a Democrat, that if somehow the recount showed her winning those three states, there'd probably be an armed revolution in this country, which would not be a good thing either.
I mean, the thing I will say is that bugs me most about this is that this was all spurred by Jill Stein and Rocky De La Fuente, you know, two candidates who are so far from winning, it's not even funny. On some level, I'm not even sure why they had standing. This wouldn't have affected their result.
Well, she had standing as a participant.
But you know, the other thing that comes to mind here is, you know, even if they go back, they audit the machines, they, you know, do the recount, and the result is effectively unchanged, you know, it's 50 votes here, 100 votes there, nothing moves. This isn't going to, you know, to the people who think something was rigged, no amount of auditing will disprove that in their minds. It's like the birth certificate situation.
Right. But I do think that when Trump wins the recounts, which I, you know, am darn sure that he will, I think it will actually help his presidency and the legitimacy of his presidency. So as somebody pointed out on television today, I forget which show I was watching, I don't understand why he's making a big deal of it. He should be for it, because unless he thinks there's some chance that three states are going to go the other way, he should want confirmation of his win.
Yeah, this is actually the best thing for him.
Yes.
Overall, this would be, go ahead, do this, let's cement this, let's sign, seal, deliver this. Now, the one thing that does drive me absolutely nuts is that Jill Stein is leading this charge, and she got 50,000 votes in Wisconsin. Hillary Clinton lost by 20,000 votes. Okay, and it's this audacity that she's like, hey guys, this isn't over, we can still win this. Like, she's all of a sudden like a team player that for the past 10 months she's been screaming how odious, and you don't have to pick either one of these terrible people, but all of a sudden she's like, wow, I think I just made a mistake. Maybe if you give the Green Party some money, we can fix this.
I agree with you. As another Democrat, I could not be angrier at Jill Stein.
Right.
I mean, as angry as I was at her the days leading up to the election and on the day of the election and then the next day when we realized that her candidacy very much helped to sink the Hillary Clinton campaign, when she came out for this recount, it was like, you bastard. I mean,
right.
I just think she's the lowest of the low. I have so little respect for this woman, who, by the way, is going to pocket a fair amount of the money that she raised, which is why I would give a dollar to it. But cool. I've been in arguments for the last 3 weeks now, 2 weeks, whatever it is, since the election. The Bernie people are saying, we told you that Hillary was a flawed candidate who couldn't win. And the Hillary people, and me included, are saying, I can't use the word I want to use. You people are the reason that people wouldn't vote for her, because you spent 6 months, including the period from when she had locked up the nomination in early June. From then on, they still continued to batter her, to spread false allegations about what she had done in her career. They continued to poison the public well about her. And that's why we had some 500,000 to 1 million or more millennials stay home and not even vote in the swing states. That's one of the main reasons we lost. There's no one reason why Hillary Clinton lost. And frankly, she could have been a stronger candidate. I'm not denying that either. There are a confluence of reasons why Hillary Clinton lost. But high, high, high on the list are the people that threw away their votes on a protest candidate and the other people who simply stayed home because they felt there's no difference between the two, and they're going to learn real fast that there's a major difference.
Kevin, I think you really do overestimate the impact of the third-party voters. Yes, there were more of them than before, but you know, as I said a couple times to friends, you've got about 1.25 to 1.5% of the electorate that always goes third party, and that in a forced choice would probably just no-show. And if they were in Australia, they'd spoil their ballots. You're really to the point that in these states, you'd have to turn a very large share of what was a very diverse third-party electorate outside of those people in order to flip them.
Cliff,
because remember,
Cliff,
yes,
you're forgetting the non-voters. Yes, you're right. About always 1.5% or so vote third-party in every presidential election. Sometimes it goes even a little bit higher than that. And you're right. It becomes much harder if you take the remaining 3%, because I believe that altogether about 5% of the electorate voted third-party. You're right, she would have had to have won 2/3 of that or better to overcome the disadvantage that she had in those swing states. But you're leaving out the people who also didn't show up, Cliff. I'm saying it's a combination of reasons why she lost.
All right, so wrapping this up, is the recount a good thing or a bad thing, DJ?
I would say for the most part, unfortunately, it's going to be a waste of time. But we have time to waste because it's in the interregnum, and apparently nothing is going to happen except for Trump's various cabinet appointments. So it's a good time to waste time, so here we go.
So this week, a couple more cabinet appointments. Some were bad, and some were really bad. I can't think of one that's not incompetent or unqualified. That's the word I'm thinking of. And I know he keeps saying that he's going to get outsiders and the best people, best people. But help me here, guys. I was on the ledge last week, and this week it's not getting better. I love Nikki Haley. I think she's fabulous. I think she's wonderful. She's one of my favorite Republicans. But he put her on a position which she has no foreign policy experience. She's
She is the United States Ambassador to the UN.
To the UN. Thank you. But she has no foreign policy experience. None whatsoever. And she's like, oh, this is the perfect spot for me, you know, because I know South Carolina.
This election, if nothing else, this election was a referendum on experience. I'm not going to make a big deal of it, but it's a truism that the president of the United States-to-be has no political experience. And so I guess he's going to populate a couple of his cabinet positions with people who are neophytes to that particular area. And that is reflective of what people voted for.
It's scary. Why don't we just say it's scary as hell?
I mean, were people really thinking that I'm going to vote for Donald Trump because he's never been in office and I like that, but I want him to surround himself with old-time experienced politicos? I'm not sure they were.
Honestly, Kevin, I'm going to disagree with you slightly. I think the overwhelming majority of people who voted for Trump were hoping and praying, hoping against hope, to use the phrase, that they would get a standard issue Republican president. They're not going to get it. We kept telling them they're not going to get it. They didn't listen to us. So they're going to a number of them are going to recoil in horror when they find out what's actually going on here. The Nikki Haley appointment, you know, that doesn't necessarily bother me as much. I mean, Daniel Moynihan did not have foreign policy experience before he was appointed ambassador to the UN. He was an analyst in the Lyndon Johnson administration. He did a fairly good job representing American interests. I don't necessarily think Andrew Young was a very good ambassador, but that was more due to the policies of the Carter administration with which he agreed and that he was espousing, and wasn't necessarily his lack of experience that was an issue. What is going to crack the Trump coalition, if it can be cracked, is traditional conservatives in the economic and foreign policy realms who will see Trump's deviations and go, wait a minute, that's not what I wanted when I voted for him. I frankly think, although I myself would not have gone with Betsy DeVos, I would have looked at Eva Moskowitz or Michelle Rhee, I think, because they actually had experience in trying
to...
For Secretary of Education, because they have actually been in the trenches and trying to move education reform, whereas Ms. DeVos has been largely a cheerleader in the background for education reform, an important cheerleader, but she doesn't have any really hands-on experience in the trench warfare that is education.
Wait, is important cheerleader mean she gives money? Because
yes,
she gave 9.5.
With all due respect, that certainly does help. When you're dealing with a movement that has the hostility of the Democratic establishment and essentially embarrasses the Republican establishment because they don't want to admit that their suburban voters don't really care about education reform because it deals with other people's children in other people's cities, in other people's school systems, you need someone who's willing to fund the campaigns, to fund the media buys and to do all the various things. And Ms. DeVos has been very good at that. My problem again, though, is that, you know, she has not been a true warrior in the field, which Ava Moskowitz certainly has been, and which Michelle Rhee was. You know,
right. Michelle Rhee was a teacher, at least. Betsy DeVos.
Stop. First of all, being a teacher is not a first qualification for running a cabinet department. Even the education department. It's a policy position. It's about policy issues. It's about how well you do with arguing policy. It is not about the fact that you were a teacher. That doesn't do it. Some of the best defense secretaries.
Go on.
Secretaries Some of the best defense secretaries never served in the military. Some of the best secretaries of state were not in the diplomatic corps beforehand.
Well, no. And I will say, of the three formal cabinet picks plus NSA, you got Wilbur Ross at Commerce, Betsy DeVos at Education, and Jeff Sessions as Attorney General. None of these are flashing, you know, a red incompetent sign to me. I'm not seeing that. Kevin and Greg, I can definitely see where you're concerned about Jeff Sessions at Justice, but none of these guys are screaming that these are not Earl Butts. Let's put it that way.
Betsy DeVos, as a teacher, and I am a teacher. Betsy DeVos scares the piss out of me. I mean, really. Why? Her views on charter schools, her views on vouchers, her views on teachers' unions. And once again, and I'll bring it up, a woman who has never set foot in a school as a teacher, as an administrator. Hell, she's never even served on a school council. You know, I mean, your school board? Sure, I'll run for a season. I mean, it's not the same as a business. It's not. Schools are different. If kids aren't doing well, you can't say, well, we'll just cut this year's model. We'll cut some money here. We'll put it here. What happened to last year's models? They didn't work out so well? We'll pick it up in the next year. They're different. You can't run schools as businesses. We've learned that time and time and time again.
Yeah, and we've also learned that the people who are currently running the schools can't run them either. We've learned that time and time again.
No, I mean, you take some of the school districts in, you know, places like I have a friend who grew up out at Ithaca, and the reality was that you had this lengthy succession of school administrators who came in and who would immediately be heading for the door when they realized that there were all these arcane rules and so forth that they had to work around when dealing with teachers who didn't know what they were doing. And the district only finally started to turn around when they were able to bring in somebody who was basically able to outweigh the Sir Humphreys of the system. You know, somebody who was willing to stick it out for 10 years. You've got a lot of people in those schools who are not doing a good job. And frankly, I think our education system does need a turnaround artist after a fashion.
We have a perfect education system for 1954. It's 2016, people.
Not for long. Let's, and I meant we're going backwards, not forward. Let's talk about some of the other proposed picks. We've heard a lot of chatter that Ben Carson might become the HUD secretary. And of course, we're still looking for a secretary of state and a secretary of defense. What do you guys think? Well, let's talk about the glamour stuff. Let's talk about state. Right now, it seems from everything that we've heard that it's down to a choice between Mitt Romney or Rudy Giuliani, although I wouldn't be surprised if a third name emerges. But assuming those
Bolton's also been circulated.
I'm sorry, who has?
John Bolton.
Oh, yeah, John Bolton. Is he still in the mix?
I think there's a shade over him now.
He's on the list that
he's such a neocon.
That the Post put.
Yeah, I think his name has fallen down that list a little.
So who do you guys like for that, of these two?
I think Romney's probably – if it's somebody on the list, it's probably going to be Romney at this point.
And how do you feel about that?
I'm all right with it. I don't think he will engage in the same policy we saw under Bush, which I think is a good thing, and DJ doesn't.
Indeed.
But I think he would be very good for handling some of those foreign policy meetings, you know, meeting with foreign heads of state and so forth. He would be good in the job, and then it would be to be seen – what form the policy actually takes under him. If he's anything like his father, he'll do whatever Trump tells him to.
Well, yeah, and that's the thing. Whoever is Secretary of State, he will do whatever the president-elect tells him to. If it is Mitt Romney who takes the job, by the way, I want my 2012 vote back, but that's an entirely different issue. I actually think it is more likely to be Giuliani because there are actually people inside the Trump camp who really don't want it to be Romney. It's probably Trump himself who's trying to float the Romney idea out there because it's a surprise. It's one of those surprise friend and foe alike deals that Trump kind of likes to do. In his mind, it's probably more symbolic because Trump will be running his own foreign policy. But I think the people around him are actually, you know, Kelly Conway thinks it's a horrible idea. I actually think the people around him are going to talk him out of it and say, look, for Secretary of State, you really can't have someone to use Lyndon Johnson's analogy, this is one where you can't have the camel pissing in the tent. You need somebody who is loyal to you and who will do what you tell them to do and who generally agrees with you. And I think that is why it will probably be Giuliani, because Giuliani will be more malleable and is clearly more Trump-dependent than Romney ever was. Maybe Romney ends up being a Secretary of Defense, which has been almost completely non-discussed. That may be the way that Trump wins it over with his people, says, fine, I'll put him in defense, because defense secretaries have thought they have roles in foreign policy for years, only be told otherwise by the president every single time. But I think for sex state, it's probably going to be Giuliani.
Okay, and my guess is that I think that Trump wants Romney. I think that people in his inner circle are pushing Giuliani. My guess is that there's a similar push and pull going on as there was before the Mike Pence choice for VP. I don't know how it's going to come down. I would be more comfortable with Romney because I just think he has bigger stature. And since neither of them have foreign policy chops, I would be more comfortable with Romney because I know his foreign policy. But I have no idea where it's going to ultimately come down.
I will say that if Trump picks Romney, it will probably be better for the Democrats because a lot of Republicans will look at Mitt Romney and go, okay, he's going to be the guy who keeps Donald Trump sane.
Yes.
And when that doesn't happen, when in fact Donald Trump is the guy who makes Mitt Romney crazy, then I think a lot more Republicans will fall off and go, oh, crap, we really need to pay attention to what the other party is doing to see if maybe they can nominate somebody sane in 2020.
I have been wrong about everything in the past, year and a half now, seeing as I said there's no way Donald Trump's going to even be president.
Oh, and you have me for company on that one, Greg. How many predictions have I messed up over the last 18 months?
It's been me and DJ who have been wrong about everything. So seeing as DJ just said it was going to be Giuliani, so I'm going to pick Romney, so one of us will be right.
There you go. One of us has to win.
One of us has to be right.
Well, and DJ and Greg, since you have picked two separate people from among the top pit list, my guess is it will probably be someone we've never heard of then, given your track records.
Wise decision, Cliff.
My big concern with the issue of who he picks as state is actually the Kellyanne Conway issue. I've been really perplexed as to why Trump's own spokesperson is actively politicking against Romney in the media. And to me, this speaks volumes about how poorly Trump is maintaining his inner circle, the lack of control he has over his own people. And if it's still going on once he's in the White House, just imagine Kellyanne Conway is the press secretary, and she's going out between daily press briefings and talking about how she disagrees with this aspect of what the president is doing.
Oh, don't, Kevin, no worries there. You know who the press secretary is going to be. It's going to be Laura Ingraham. It's not going to be Kellyanne Conway. So you've got nothing to worry about there.
Got nothing to worry about there.
You have entirely different problems.
So let's talk about a couple of other things, because the world still does move forward even as Donald Trump puts together his cabinet. The Standing Rock protest has been going on now. Well, it's been going on actually for months and months, but it's been in the news in a big way the last couple of weeks. Do you guys follow this at all? Do you have any opinion about what's going on there?
I've kept a bit of an eye on it. My impression is that the discussion of this has been largely one-sided. That's mainly because it has been largely one-sided on social media. I haven't really looked at it in general media very much. To the extent that I have, what I have found is that the actual situation on the ground is really very different from what the vocal opponents of the pipeline would have us believe. The actual property owners on the route of the pipeline have all approved it. Most of the other stakeholders have largely given it the okay. The Standing Rock Tribe is, as far as I understand it, the only group that has opposed it. And from what I have read, they have largely avoided and deliberately sabotaged attempts to contact them from the pipeline group or from authorities and so forth, based on essentially a strategy of, well, if we put up complete massive resistance, then they'll just go away and they'll give up. Well, they're not giving up. because of what they have managed to work out with the property owners on the pipeline route itself, and the fact that they've won over that the Army Corps of Engineers seems to agree that this is as safe as we can get. I want to be careful with my words here, of course, because I'm not going to say that the Standing Rock Tribe has no standing, forgive the term.
Dumb-tish.
Yeah, but I think my impression is that they've largely handled this badly politically, and that they have, someone apparently gave them the impression they could turn this into Keystone 2, and that they could find a way to actually stop this pipeline from happening in its entirety. And that just really isn't the case, because the international implications of Keystone that allowed Washington to get involved really don't exist here. And I think they should have tried a different route. That said, I will say that the pipeline proponents have not really covered themselves in glory here, because for the most part, they really seem to have been, at least in social media terms, they've been sort of silent running. The proponents think they have the facts on their side. Based on what I've read, I think they are correct, but they've done a terrible PR job. And as a result of that, they're losing the PR battle very, 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 very badly. So I think really no one's covering themselves in glory. Both sides could have handled this differently, but for whatever reason, they have chosen not to. And this is how tragedies happen.
Yeah. When well, there is going to be a tragedy there. Anytime you're dealing with Indians on a reservation and tear gas canisters being hurled at protesters, you've got a bad situation to begin with.
Yeah, that's never good.
Okay,
that's never good.
But let's forget the political optics of it, even though that's a major component of it. Let's just step aside from that for a second. It seems to me there's two very simplistic, and I use that in the good sense, sides to this argument. One is the science that says, look, we're going to lay this pipe underneath the Missouri River with the highest safety technology that we have to date. But trust in government and trust in institutions, especially private corporations in the energy sector, has been so eroded over the past 20, 30 years. Why should anyone believe that? And so I can't blame the tribes for not trusting the Army Corps of Engineers and not trusting the company that wants to lay this stuff, which, by the way, as I read today in the papers, Donald Trump owns stock in that company, so that pipe is going to be laid,
and it's going to be a huge pipe.
And there is going to be a huge violent clash in ahead of that, because Trump is going to go in there with bulldozers and tanks and move those people out, and that is not going to be a pretty day.
Those people believe in what they're doing, and they're not going to want to move.
Okay, and with that, I'm going to move things along because we are running long. There was a passing this week that has affected the United States and generations of Americans, but, you know, we're going to have to forget about Florence Henderson today.
I was going to make that joke.
Generalissimo, Fidel Castro is still dead.
Yes. And maybe we'll talk about that next week if he's still dead. But until then, we want to thank everyone for listening. Please like us on Facebook at facebook.com/moreperfectunionpodcast and share our link on your Facebook news feed so your friends can find us too. And if you like political debates and would like to be a part of ours, join us on Facebook in our political discussion group, Open Fire. We're all there and we'd love to see you there too. Until next week, ta-ta.
I was going to make a Cuba Libra, but all I had was rum and coke. So.